delighted to have here at the Federalist Society today the author of this brand new book, Vivek Ramaswamy, Woke Incorporated. You can get, there will be a book signing immediately after this where it'll be autographing copies of the book. So I urge you to pick one up. It's a heck of a fun read. It's very insightful, but it's also just a really fun read. So, Vivek went to law school, but obviously, is not a lawyer, so that means he actually still knows how to write. he hasn't had all those years of legal practice to undo his natural writing ability. So we're going to talk for a little bit here, and we're going to have a fireside discussion here for a while, and then eventually we'll turn to questions. We'll probably end up running a little long since we're starting a little bit late on this session. So, Vivek, welcome to the Federalist Society.
Thank you. Glad you could be with us. Glad to be here, and thank you very much. Folks able to hear me okay? If the microphone system's working well, seems like it.
All right.
Good. So what I'll do is I'm going to kick off just for 5 minutes or so, give you a little bit about my background. I'll lay out the thesis of the book in a nutshell, and I was really gratified by an email that I got from Todd last night, which I thought was going to be a short email for this talk, and it was like an essay-length email of the topics that we have to cover. So I want to quickly get to that because I think we have a good discussion ahead of us with some great critical questions from you, Todd, that I appreciated. In a nutshell, I was born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio. I was a scientist by background, went to Harvard, studied molecular biology, graduated in 2007. Instead, I got into the world of biotech investing after I graduated on the eve of the 2008 financial crisis, something that actually influences a lot of the topics that we'll talk about. Worked at a hedge fund in biotech investing from 2007 to 2010. Told my bosses that I had an itch to study law and political philosophy, decided to go to Yale Law School at the time. Something interesting happened is the bosses at the hedge fund said, go ahead and keep your job, just manage a portfolio from us from New Haven. So I said, that sounded like a great dual gig. So I did that for 3 years from 2010 to 2013. When I came back to my full-time job as an investor, it turned out I'd grown accustomed to having law school as well as a hedge fund portfolio to manage. Now it was just the hedge fund portfolio. I had some spare time. And so I did something that actually changed my life, which was I did a short-lived stint as a stand-up comedian in New York City. It wasn't very good. I did about 10 shows, and I got one piece of advice, which I'll share with all of you, which actually influenced my future direction, which was to take a notebook and carry it around to wherever you went and write something down whenever it annoys the heck out of you. And it turns out that's supposedly a good method for stand-up comedy. Didn't work for me. but it did. What did work for me is I took that notebook around to write down all the ways the pharmaceutical industry annoyed me, and that ended up being the business plan that gave rise to a biotech company that I founded in 2014, led that company as CEO for 7 years before stepping down this January ahead of writing the book that I think we're going to spend most of our time talking about. And part of the reason I stepped down is the nature of the topics in the book, I think in the environment that we're in today, if I was to speak candidly, was going to be a controversial book that might have risked having blowback from my business, and I really wanted to separate my voice as a citizen from my voice as a CEO. The basic case I make in the book is that our business culture and our political culture are both better off when we separate each from the other. And a big part of what I do is I trace the modern orthodoxy that most businesses, especially big businesses in America, pledge fealty to today. That includes the so-called emergence of a newly woke culture that posits a theory of individual identity that says that your identity is based on your race, your gender, and your sexual orientation, that if you're black, you're inherently disadvantaged, that if you're white, you're inherently privileged, no matter your economic background or your upbringing, that's what your identity is all about. And the question that I trace in the book is how that philosophy, how that worldview, how that theory of identity went from being a worldview that was about challenging prevailing orthodoxies when it was born at the beginning of the critical theory movement decades ago, to actually going from being about challenging the system to becoming the system. And the answer that I offer in the book, in part, is that it is the moment when wokeness met capitalism, when it got supercharged with the muscle of corporate power, that it became unstoppable. And that's a story that traces back to the 2008 financial crisis, after which big business was the bad guys in this country. They were able to ultimately apologize for that by embracing a new strand of the left that used to represent a threat to corporate power, to embrace a new strand of the left that actually offered an alibi from the Occupy Wall Street movement, something I expect we'll talk more about. Now, one of the things I'll just say in closing, in the start of my opening remarks, this is a book about woke capitalism, but I don't use that term anymore. Woke capitalism is the variety of stakeholder capitalism that is merged with particularly postmodern woke values centering on individual identity. But I don't use the term woke capitalism anymore because I think it's imprecise. I think stakeholder capitalism or woke capitalism really refer to at least three different phenomena, each of which are, I think, uniquely problematic in their own right, but problematic for different reasons. And I think the relevant solutions that we ought to talk about also are really different to the three sources of problematic strands of stakeholder or woke capitalism. The first of those is that of the so-called woke executive. This is in a case in which an executive is using his or her seat of corporate power and the shareholder resources associated with it to advance a particular agenda at the expense of shareholders. Here, the shareholder is the victim, the executive is the perpetrator, and that's one brand of what we see in the landscape of so-called modern woke capitalism. That's distinct from the so-called woke investor, the socially conscious investor, pick your word of choice, the ESG-oriented investor, who actually is actually in the opposite position. Now no longer the victim, but actually the perpetrator, suggesting that you, the executive, work for us, the investor, and we demand, as a condition of our investment, that you, the executive, lead the company in a way that advances a narrow, monolithic social agenda. Think BlackRock, think the entire ESG movement fitting that description. Both of those forms of so-called woke capitalism are still different from the third strain, which is not a top-down phenomenon, as the woke executive or the woke investor represent, but a bottom-up phenomenon of woke consumerism, a new model in our economy where you have a generation of consumers, often people my age or younger, who demand that the companies that they buy their products from, the companies they do business with, the places where they bank, abide by the same values that match their own values as consumers. And that's a problem, in my opinion, it's a problem at least, to which the solution is not going to rest in law or is not going to rest in a technical solution, but is going to ultimately rest in our culture, addressing the hunger for a cause of an entire generation that's hungry for purpose, hungry for meaning, and hungry for identity, but has that hunger for purpose left unfulfilled, thinking they're going to fill a moral hunger by going to Ben and Jerry's and getting a cup of ice cream with a cup of morality on the side, not realizing that that moral hunger can only be satisfied with more substantial fare than fast food. And I think that's actually the biggest and, I believe, most important theme of the book. So though I do expect we'll be talking about a lot of the technical solutions relating to the so-called woke executives or woke investors, including some legal proposals that I make in the book, I did want to say at the outset that I think the most important part of the book and the most important part of what motivates me to do what I'm doing right now, speaking across the country and shining a light on these issues, is really to fill that generational hunger for purpose and hunger for meaning that I think ultimately dilutes the so-called woke agenda to irrelevance rather than stamping it out of existence using either state or other forms of centralized power. With that said, Todd, I look forward to discussion.
Great. Well, thanks for that summary. And as you can see just from his summary, he's a very colorful and fun writer with these very strong images. And what struck me about the book is everybody in this room now, I think, is, or most people are familiar with Milton Friedman's traditional critique of stakeholder capitalism. But you have you sort of talk about Friedman, but you have a different critique of stakeholder capitalism. Would you tell us about that?
Yeah, in some ways, it's the inverse of what Milton Friedman argued 50 years ago when he said that the social purpose of a corporation is to pursue profit. Milton Friedman's main concern was that the expansion of our politics to infect business would make businesses run less efficiently, would make them less profitable, leaving everyone worse off for an economy that was less efficient than it otherwise would have been if it were operating according to the norm of maximizing profit. That was his principal concern. I'm sympathetic to that concern. It resonates with me. However, my principal thesis in the book is actually the inverse. I worry about the way in which the expansion of big business in this country actually risks infecting our politics. Because stakeholder capitalism is a new philosophy that says that corporations should pursue not only the sale of products and services for profit, but also advance other societal interests. And to me, that actually demands a concentration of not only market power in the marketplace of products, but ideological power in the marketplace of ideas that goes far beyond what the role of the corporation was supposed to be in our broader, more pluralistic spheres of our lives. we ought to be fine living in a world in which corporations are endowed with special privileges like legislatively codified limited liability, something we can talk about more. We should be fine with that as long as they're wielding that power in the market where it was intended. But we should not want to live in a world in which we have the modern Dutch East India companies of our day operating here on American soil, a Frankensteinian monster that left its cage, left roaming free over American democracy to affect every other sphere of our lives far beyond the market. And so in many ways, that's the mirror image reverse concern that Milton Friedman had of politics infecting business. My concern is actually the extent to which stakeholder capitalism demands that business infects our politics. And I hoped and continue to hope and am somewhat encouraged by the way in which the left ought to be every bit as worried about that expansion of corporate power as the right. It was only 10 years ago that it was a hallmark card-carrying membership signifier on the left to be opposed to the Supreme Court's holding in Citizens United. And yet, to me, stakeholder capitalism is Citizens United on steroids because it not only permits corporations to influence electoral outcomes through something as superficial as campaign contributions, but it actually demands that corporations influence our politics by weighing in on matters ranging from environmental justice to racial justice to the right ways to fight climate change. And I think that those are questions that ought to be sorted out through the democratic process of free speech and open debate in the public square, where every person's voice and vote is weighted equally, unadjusted by the number of dollars that they control. That's the American vision, in contrast to the old world European vision, where a small group of elite business leaders and labor elites and church leaders would get together behind closed doors to decide what was going to be right for the common good. Maybe that works in old world Europe, maybe even works in contemporary Japan, but that isn't the essence of what the American way is supposed to be all about. That's a big motivator for me to have written the book.
And what one of the things that's very striking me is you tie this to something we take for granted, which is the whole idea of limited liability corporations. And sort of why don't you tell us about how this point, your version of stakeholder capitalism relates to the underlying issue of limited liability and what you would do about the confluence of those when corporations engage in woke capitalism.
Sure. So this is a great point for this audience. I don't normally talk about this
exactly
in audiences that may fall asleep for the following section, but I'm hopeful that's not going to be the case for the audience we have here. So, look, one of the most compelling, I think the most compelling case for stakeholder capitalism is that at the birth of the corporation, the state endowed on corporate shareholders a special legal privilege of limited liability at the top of that list. There's other legal privileges too, but limited liability at the top of the list, which says that the shareholders of a corporation get the upside of its profits but do not bear liability for the downside of its debts or other forms of liability. Many people would credit the Industrial Revolution with the invention of limited liability. In fact, The Economist magazine said as much in the 20th century. However, what the stakeholder capitalists argue is that in return for that great gift of limited liability, there was an implicit grand bargain in return, which is that these corporations owe an implicit debt to actually take societal interests into account that go beyond the benefit of shareholders. That's kind of the quid pro quo at the inception of the corporation. Milton Friedman never had a good response to that. In fact, he skimmed over in his famous 1970 essay. He didn't really respond to what I think was the most compelling account for stakeholder capitalism in the first place. What I argue in the book, and I trace a lot of corporate legal history to back it up, is that actually there was a grand bargain at the birth of the corporation. Actually, there was a quid pro quo. It wasn't an implicit one, it was an explicit one. When in return for limited liability, the quo in return for that quid was the demand that corporate directors focus only on maximizing profit for their shareholders, not to protect the shareholders, but to protect the rest of society from corporate overreach. That if we were going to create Frankenstein's monster, then we wanted to keep that Frankensteinian monster in its cage of the market so that it wasn't free to use that cloak of limited liability to be able to exercise far more power than the framers of not only the Constitution, but I think even the framers of American corporate law ever imagined corporations wielding in the sphere of American democracy, in our family life, in our civic life, and so on. And so I actually think that is as many would call it, maybe a revisionist account of corporate history. I think it is a true account of the intellectual underpinning of the quid pro quo at the inception of why society gave corporations and corporate shareholders limited liability. But I think that also puts into relief what I would sort of argue to a shareholder like BlackRock who demands that they engage in corporate activism using the corporate shield as a veil that protects them from being held liable for the advocacy of that corporation. I think limited liability makes all the sense in the world if you're an investor investing in corporations to pursue profit. But if you're an investor investing in corporations as a shield for pursuing corporate advocacy, then there's no reason that limited liability should cover that scope of activities. Are there difficulties in the legal implementation of that? Sure. I think this was intended principally as a provocation to a conversation that traces back to the origin story of what corporations were supposed to do in the first place. But I did hope, including in audiences like this, to sort of use that as a provocation to be able to at least trace that original corporate purpose rather than an explicit legal proposal that I'm making per se.
Yeah, because it was fascinating to me because, you know, the logic, as you laid out, limited liability, is it allows these corporations to mass these huge amounts of investment capital that can provide returns. But, as you said, the byproduct is once they've got all this investment capital, once they've got so much money and such a big footprint, we got to keep it, as you said, in the cage. And you go on and you talk about stakeholder capitalism. And you have this this phrase. I'll just read it to you, and then you could tell me what you mean. When CEOs have to pick one master to serve, they serve themselves. And the problems with stakeholderism is the more people you become accountable, the less you're accountable to anyone. So what do you mean by that?
Well, stakeholder capitalism consummates the coup for the managerial class in this country. What it tells them is by becoming accountable to everyone, you actually become accountable to no one. And I think that that's one of the things that the executive class has actually managed to pull off is the way in which they're able to disguise poor corporate performance or disguise accountability to their shareholders to be able to say that actually we were accountable to everyone in the first place. And I think that's one of the undercurrents underlying this entire debate is the rise of a new managerial class in our country that ultimately betrays the very stakeholders whose interests they were supposed to represent in the first place. I think that's pervasive in corporate America. I don't think it's limited to corporate America. I see a new rise of a managerial class in our universities that betray the essential purpose of a university at behest of the things that they are supposed to administer as a sort of administrative state within the university itself. I call the deep state counterpart in corporate America, I call it deep corporate. It's effectively an administrative bureaucracy designed to carry out goals that are actually oftentimes, if not orthogonal, downright counterproductive to the essential purpose of the corporation, whatever it may be, to provide products and services that matter to people who need them. And so that's a separate sociological point that I make in one of the chapters in the book is the way in which the rise of this managerial class, Michael Lind, for example, has written about the way in which it's a fluid managerial class. Some of the same people who may occupy positions as a diplomat one day, maybe a university leader a different day, may serve on a corporate board the same day. It's this horizontal managerial class whose professional purpose is really to serve themselves at the expense of the very true essential purposes of the institutions that they were supposed to be serving in the name of actually achieving great self-service monetarily or otherwise in the process.
Let's turn to the tech behemoths because you sort of laid out this model of stakeholder capitalism, this concern about corporations, exercising power over in the political market. Your critique of big tech and tech behemoths struck me as a bit different. But why don't you tell us about that?
Well, look, I think that there are, certainly two kinds of you can cut the stakeholder capitalism pie in along a different axis as well, not just executives, investors, or consumers, but along a different axis of whether people are being authentic about it or whether they're being scammy about it. And I think that what I mostly set out to indict in the book at the start was what I think of as the scammy kind of woke capitalism, the kind in which you pretend like you care about something other than profit and power precisely to gain more of each. That's what I set out to indict in the book. I think if I learned something about my own views by the end of the book, it was that if there's anything scarier than the scammy kind of stakeholder capitalism, it's actually the authentic kind, the way in which you're actually authentically using your position of corporate power to be able to effectuate values that actually government never could through the front door because it operates under constitutional constraint. And one of the things that I see happening with big tech censorship today, or sort of the behavior of big tech, including big tech censorship online, is the confluence of the two, where on one hand you have Jack Dorsey, who doesn't need any more dollars. He has billions of dollars already. The marginal utility to him to have an extra per share profit dollar to Twitter is almost nothing personally. The rate limiter for the power he's able to exercise isn't the number of green pieces of paper he has. It is the scope of what green pieces of paper themselves can buy. And the ability to exercise quasi-state power or even supra-state power, monarchical power, over what ideas can and can't be discussed in a democracy is something that's actually far more powerful than any elected official is able to wield in the first place. Now, what I think Silicon Valley recognized was that the biggest threat to Silicon Valley's monopoly power used to come from the classical left that was skeptical of concentrations of corporate power, for example, in the hands of Silicon Valley titans. So what they recognized was actually if they could instead engage in a grand bargain to be able to lend that corporate power to advance certain objectives of at least one strand of that classical left, then they could effectively expect that strand of the left to look the other way when it came to leaving their monopoly power intact. And nowhere more clearly have we seen that than in the way that we've seen big tech censorship play out over the last year. If you ask me, should a private company be able to decide what does and doesn't show up on their website? My ordinary answer to that question is yes, if they're actually behaving as a private company. However, I think one of the things we've learned over the last year is that these companies are not behaving as private companies. They are effectively responding to a combination of threats and inducements by the federal government to do through the back door what the federal government could not do directly through the front door under the Constitution. You can look at the hearings over the last year, Democratic senators and congressmen telling the big tech companies and their CEOs, we're going to come after you, we're going to regulate you, we're going to make it swift, we're going to make it aggressive. Those are almost exact quotes, threats at behest of taking down hate speech and misinformation as defined by the party in power. Now, there's this pesky thing called the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States that prevents the government from doing it directly, so they threaten these private companies to do it. More recently, they're coordinating directly with the White House to take down, again, certain forms of disfavored misinformation as determined by the party in power. And then to top it off, there's actually a federal statute that immunizes those companies from liability for doing the very thing that the federal government wants them to do, which is to take down speech whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. And I quote you directly, that is language in Section 230C2 of the Communications Decency Act. And so there's a great case, among others, Brentwood, which lays out alternative conditions in the alternative, for which there would be a basis for finding state action in the guise of a private company. Either if the private actor is responsive to the threats of a government actor, or if there is a willful participation in a joint activity, coordination in the activities of the government actor and the private actor, or if the government actually immunizes the private company to do what government, against liability for doing what government cannot do directly. In the case of big tech censorship, we have not one of those conditions met, not two of them, but all three. It's actually a great case, Bantam Books, which laid out a prosecutor that wanted to sell a book, a bookstore owner wanted to sell a book. Prosecutor who didn't like the book that was disfavored told him to take it down. The bookstore owner says no. Then he threatens him with prosecution. The bookstore owner says, okay, in that case, I will take down the book. The court says no, that's state action. Same thing with respect to the railroads. And I'll finish with this one, Todd, because it maps onto Section 230. You know, the government may have at times in our past wanted to randomly search the passengers of railroads and the people who work for railroads. Again, there's this pesky thing called the Fourth Amendment, which prevents us from being able to allow the government to do that. However, what government thought it cleverly could do was immunize these railroad companies to be able to be immune from liability from their employees and passengers for having the railroads instead directly conduct those random drug tests instead. Again, the Supreme Court says, not so fast. The government cannot immunize a private actor to induce them to do what government can't do directly. So I think that that's the underappreciated theory as compared to antitrust law and concentration of corporate power. I think it's a bit of a lightning rod, a feigned retreat from warfare, I think, where, you know, I think a lot of the conversation is going today in the wrong direction, as opposed to first at least going to the more obvious low-hanging fruit of finding state action in the guise of a private enterprise. And I think that the good news is those aren't changes that require legislative action, though I would love to see legislative action that made Section 230 an opt-in statute to say that if you opt into Section 230C2, it comes with strings attached, namely abiding by the Constitution. That's what I'd love to see. But even in absence of that, provides an ability for people today to bring cases under existing case law to say that if it is state action in disguise, then the Constitution still applies. And if there's one thing I learned from the O.J. Simpson trial, you need a pithy rhyme to be able to get across, so that's the one I go with. But that's the basic principle that I make in that section of the book.
Let's turn to the so you describe yourself in the book as a traitor to your class, your CEO class you've been talking about. But you also suggest you're a traitor to your generation, your woke generation, and they're kind of the second part of this triad. You said the woke consumers, all right? Especially the younger people. What do you see is going on there? It's a very fascinating insight to an old guy like me.
Well, I mean, I think the first part is I don't have too much more to say. I mean, I wasn't born into elite America. I have lived in elite America for the last 15 years, Harvard, Yale, hedge funds, biotech company, et cetera. And, you know, I wasn't free to really speak my mind when I was in, say, my position as the CEO of a fast-growing biotech company or whatever. I am now as an ordinary citizen. And I think that there are many Americans who don't find themselves in that privileged position to be able to speak their mind for risk of being able to put food on the dinner table. And I think we do live in a moment in American history where people have to make a choice between being able to speak their mind freely or taking the risk of being able to put food on the dinner table. I personally think that our country isn't one that forces you to choose between the American dream and the First Amendment. We are the quintessential nation where you get to enjoy both of those things at once. And that relates to some of my legislative proposals to codify that reality in American life today by making political belief a protected class, right up there next to race, sex, religion, and national origin. So long as we're going to have protected classes at all, which is a debate that not many, very many people are willing to visit, I am. But if we're going to say that ship has already sailed and we're not going to revisit whether protected classes ought to be had at all, then we at least have to apply those standards even-handedly. And a lot of, by the way, the deep corporate infrastructure that I described earlier was born out of a history of complying with those protected class statutes that created a corporate infrastructure that was supposed to first police for discrimination, then become proponents of anti-racism, which then create the very conditions for the kind of political discrimination that we see today. This isn't an accident and an accidental hypocrisy. This is actually deeply, intimately linked, such that the causal relationship is such that we can't have protected classes for race, gender, and sexual orientation, and religion, and national origin if we don't also protect political belief. You can't have it both ways and make your choice. So that's where, for the traitor to the class bit, that's what I'm talking about in terms of creating conditions for change in corporate America. The generational point, I mean, that's a much longer discussion. And I think that it's one I'm happy to have. But, you know, I think we have a hole the size of God in our nation's heart right now and in my generation's heart. And I think if God and country don't fill that vacuum, something else will instead. That is what makes wokeism so appealing to an entire generation, is it is a secular religion without God, but a religion nonetheless that serves as opium for the American soul that's hungering for something far more meaningful, that we have spent a decade celebrating and being taught to celebrate our diversity as a people. But one of the things I often say is that our diversity is meaningless if there's nothing greater that binds us together across that diversity, or else we're all thousand of us in here or whatever, nothing more than a different looking group of higher mammals occupying a common space, doing what our iPhones tell us to do on a given afternoon. That isn't America. And I think that one of the things that we actually hunger for is a revival of that shared sense of identity and purpose across that diversity that we've lost in my generation. But I actually am optimistic about Gen Z, which is on the other side of this transformation, who, you know, something about being 19 years old that makes you want to stand up to the system and stand up to an orthodoxy. And maybe for a millennial, that was adhering to the new temple of wokeness. But actually, the temple of wokeness is the ruling temple in America today. If you really want to be heterodox or countercultural or a hippie, you might actually try joining the Federalist Society today. So that's kind of what I would say. Yeah.
We're going to turn to questions in a second, but I just have one or two final questions. One of the points you make, you talk about China, and you use this term,
yes,
Bai Zhao, or you could
tell
Bai Zhu, right? And it relates to what you were just saying about the impact of woke ideas on national unity and the like. And you know, the sort of the third member of this triad is China.
That's right.
And sort of what this does for the country larger, not just in this context. Do you want to tell us what that term means, because pronounce it again, and then tell us sort of how you think this fits in.
Well, Baizhuo is certainly it's the Chinese equivalent of what folks in the USSR used to refer to in the United States as useful idiots. They refer to woke left white people in the United States, and they really use it to ridicule us and laugh at us. That's more of a joking aside.
Right.
I think the reality is this is probably the first book that exposes the geopolitical implications of the woke movement in the United States and the movement of woke-infused stakeholder capitalism in the United States. Because one of the cases I make is that China is able to use the new class of international arbiters of moral justice, global corporations, as vectors to create a false moral equivalence between the United States and China, and thereby erode our most important geopolitical asset of all, and that is not our nuclear arsenal. It is our moral standing on the global stage. And if you have any doubt about that, listen to what Xi Jinping says, or his deputies say on global diplomatic settings today. Last year, he's pressed on the Uyghur human rights crisis in Xinjiang. First thing he says is that Black Lives Matter shows the United States is no better. Top diplomat comes to Alaska this year, lectures us for 15 minutes on how the U.S. should stop slaughtering Black Americans and that China hopes the U.S. does better on human rights, which would be laughable if it weren't for the fact that Disney, for example, would say that it can't shoot a film in the state of Georgia if Georgia passes an anti-abortion statute. But last year, we'll go to the Xinjiang province, literally ground zero of the Uyghur human rights crisis, and film Mulan without compunction, without saying a peep, until the very end of the film, and it's in the credits to the film today, you can watch it, that says, we thank the local Xinjiang authorities for allowing us the privilege of filming here, including the very authorities who have enslaved over 1 million Uyghurs in concentration camps and subject them to forced sterilization for being a religious minority. That is the dichotomy that I think reveals the folly of one of the predecessors of stakeholder capitalism, flawed policy in the United States, embraced largely by Republicans and Democrats, by the way, in the 1990s, of so-called democratic capitalism. Democratic capitalism was a forefather of a progenitor of stakeholder capitalism because it was another one of these philosophies that thought you could use capitalism as a vector to do something beyond distribute products and services. It thought that you could use capitalism as a vehicle to spread democracy abroad. The idea that you could export Big Macs and Happy Meals and somehow that was going to spread democracy to places like China, we thought we could use our money, our investment, to get them to be more like us. China actually woke up, but they realized they could turn that game on its head. They now stop you from entering the Chinese market if you criticize the CCP, but roll out the red carpet if you criticize the United States. They realized they could use their money to get us to be more like them. Or even one step better, they realized they could use our money to get us to be more like them. Send back Disney movies and Nike sneakers as Trojan horses to undermine the United States from within. And I use the Trojan horse analogy in an intentional sense that, you know, look, the Battle of Troy would have never been settled militarily. Greece would have never defeated Troy through military prowess, just as China will never defeat the United States on grounds of military prowess alone either. But what China's been able to do is to use our own corporations as Trojan horses to create that false moral equivalence between the United States and China. And I don't know if we woke up to that, or we ought to woke up to that, or wake up to that, but that's something that we all ought to be aware of as we understand the ways in which China understands the kinks in our cultural armor in a way that we have very little understanding of in reverse. And I think that might be one of the great geopolitical threats to us in the decade ahead.
Then approach the microphone if anybody has any questions. Do I see somebody? Well, I'll just ask a follow-up question, because one of the things on this point of unity and confidence, one of the things that struck me that was interesting about your book is you note the way in which this isn't just relegated to the economic sphere. It's not just the political sphere, but it's infected everything. It's infected our mediating institutions.
Yeah.
The things that generally were, you know, the Tocquevillian sort of things that bind us together is Americans. And I thought that was a very profound point, if you would just say a word about them.
So Tocqueville, I think, would be rolling in his grave, because I think that one of the things that binds us together in a divided polity are apolitical institutions outside of our politics that hold us together. The baseball stadiums of this country, the football stadiums of this country, bring us together, whether we're Black or white, whether we're Democrat or Republican, whether we're man or woman. Those are the spheres that bring us together. And once we get to a place where we have two forms of coffee, left-wing coffee and right-wing coffee, as we do today, If we get to the point where we have left-wing baseball and right-wing baseball, I think that will mark the beginning of the end of the Tocquevillian vision of the American experiment as we know it. And I think that one of the things I'd love to see is the restoration of an apolitical private sector that creates that basis of a mediating institution that provides the basis for solidarity in an otherwise divided polity. And the last thing I'll say before we go to the questions is, what's at stake in this issue? This isn't some sort of arcane and cryptic issue of stakeholder capitalism, you know, an academic concept for lawyers to reflect on. I think at the heart of this question rests the real inquiry to what it means to be American in the year 2021. I think we don't have a good answer to that question today. And it's a tough question to answer because, speaking as a first-generation American myself, I have conflicting impulses, just as I believe probably every one of us in this room do. On one hand, we want to be individuals pursuing our own dream through a system of free market capitalism, which is the best expression of the individualist side of our American identity. On the other hand, we want to also be part of something greater and bigger than ourselves, part of a whole that's greater than the sum of its parts, expressed that's through our system of democracy. And I think that the beauty of the American identity is that America isn't one of those things. It's both of them. Capitalism and democracy, individualism and unity, the wealth of nations and the Declaration of Independence, both in 1776. America needs both of its parents to be the best version of itself. And I think sometimes, in order to save the child, you need to keep the parents apart. That's the case I make in the book for separating capitalism from democracy in order to save each from infecting the other. So with that,
I think we've only got maybe just time for one question, so we'll go right here in front and then we'll have to move on. So go ahead, please.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Jonathan Cohen. I'm with Sidley Austin. And first, I want to say that I loved your book.
Thank
you. It was, aside from the Bible, one of the best books I've ever read.
Oh, my God.
So my question and concern relate to the size of the woke industry. As best I can tell, every corporation, every law firm, every consulting firm, every government agency has a bloated bureaucracy of woke officials. And that's in addition to all the diversity consultants and trainers, et cetera, that are around. So the two questions I have are, one, what is the size? Is it $10 billion, $100 billion, $1 trillion? And two, in light of how big it is it too big to go away?
Yeah, so I think that the way I define the size doesn't just come from a job description and a corporate org chart. Part of the way it spreads is that the militia of that bureaucracy grows by in part infecting and recruiting people who already exist and were serving other purposes in their respective institutions, be it the university or be it the corporation, to become part of their militia too. So I think that if it were a question of seats occupied in a corporate org chart, then you could ask the question, is it too big or not? I view the question a little bit differently is the way in which our change of culture can actually recruit every one of those people all the way back to the HR bureaucracies, back to advancing a vision of sort of shared American identity that transcends the woke demands of the day that have temporarily co-opted that bureaucracy for what it is. So one of the things that I have learned over the last year is that we're not going to make a lot of progress given where that bureaucracy, the DEI, in the diversity industrial complex flying under the banner of DEI represents today. We're not going to make a lot of progress by trying to fight that back and being anti-DEI. That ship has sailed. But I do think there's a more promising approach towards reviving affirmative alternative values that can maybe dilute the potency and the poisonous potency of the alternative to less relevance. So one of the things that I frequently talk about in corporate settings is reviving the pursuit of excellence and opportunity and civility. And because these things like CSR, ESG, and DEI tend to come in threes, I go with EOC for excellence, opportunity, and civility. But to be able to offer affirmative ideas that I think can actually recruit some of those who have been captured into the bureaucracy to be plied back out of that bureaucracy. Because at the end of the day, what I said earlier about millennials isn't really just true about millennials. It's true about human beings. We each hunger and thirst for an identity and a purpose that's greater than ourselves. And at a moment where that hunger is unsatisfied by things like patriotism and faith or hard work or family or whatever used to fulfill that hunger for purpose and meaning, we have to fill it with something else instead. And I think that that's actually going to be our best way to fight back against not only the bureaucracy, but the orthodoxies that that bureaucracy administers. But it is too late to just fight it back, because that's actually only going to worsen the problem by strengthening the bureaucracy in its defense itself. Hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you.
So I'm getting the hook over here from the boss. And one of the things I appreciated about the book was, as you heard, he ends on an optimistic tone. For a pessimist like me, it was inspiring to think that there may be a way out of this. So it's a great book. We're going to have a book signing. Where is it, Dean? Right down at mezzanine. Yep. So be a book signing down the hall. So and a chance to talk, I think, a little bit more. So thank you, everybody, for your attention and your questions. Thanks.
Thank you.